except I've got a room full of witnesses. So. Well, I'll start out by repeating that question. Just find the play button here. This is not starting off well. There we go. So could audio archives actually be the next hot location for field research? In some ways, that's a pretty big question. And I'm inclined to think that before I start talking about this, I should maybe just stop right here and come back when I have about 25 years of experience in archives. But right now, I'm coming to this question as a newcomer to the field of archiving and also as a relative newcomer to the field of ethnomusicology. My vantage point is one of seeing two fields that I believe are rapidly and significantly changing. In this case, I see them coming back to a point of synergy that they once had. And as I talk about field research and researchers today, my reference point is in ethnomusicology, but scholars and students in other related fields are also part of this group of people who underuse our resources right now, but they could really benefit from them. And in particular, I'm thinking of other anthropologically related disciplines like linguistics, folklore, and cultural anthropology itself. Scholars from fields that don't have these sort of archives and libraries, phobia, hang-ups, are already putting our collections to good use, and in particular, I'm thinking of historical musicology, where I know some excellent work is being done right now. Before addressing this question, though, I should answer another one. Why ask this question in the first place? That is, what is changing that would prompt this kind of an exploration right now? As in almost every area of human endeavor at the start of the 21st century, there's a whole lot that's changing. I don't need to tell you that the nature of libraries and archives is changing, and that there are ideas from every side about what a library or an archive should be or should not try to be in the age of Googling. Just a side note, believe it or not, the verb to Google has actually shown up in at least two major dictionaries at this point. Ethnomusicology is changing too, having recently marked 50 years under that name, though the forerunner discipline of comparative musicology goes back at least a half century earlier. Another area of change that comes into play here is human media interaction. The expectations are changing not only for what types of media are available, but also for the ways in which even the traditional paper medium is handled and made available. For those of you who don't follow the history of academic ethnomusicology, I'll give a brief background of the split between ethnomusicology and archives. I won't cover this history in great detail, although Rhonda Seewald, who's right here, has already done that in an article exploring the theoretical stumbling blocks that exist between ethnomusicologists and archives. And in fact, this paper is indebted to her article because it was my reading it about a year ago that really got me thinking about this idea of getting ethnomusicologists back into the archives. There are at least two other really good articles by Anthony Seeger that discuss this issue. What's interesting about the Seeger articles is that the first was written over 20 years ago, which, as far as I can tell, is well before the archives question was a topic of conversation. That conversation seems to have blossomed in the last 5 years or so, although maybe it took the preceding 15 for Seeger's comments to really sink in and take root. So likewise, I owe a lot to his ideas here. Today, there is still in many quarters a widespread malaise when it comes to using archives as a research base. Seeger calls it an image problem for archives. John Vollier has a term that I like even better. He calls it archival ennui, which I think I'm having DVD ennui right now. But historically, the connection between ethnomusicology and archives is deep. And even fraternal. Many writers, in fact, trace the genesis of comparative musicology, the forerunner discipline of ethnomusicology, to the advent of sound recording. Artur Simon goes further, pegging the date precisely at September 1900, when Carl Stumpf and Otto Abraham made their first set of Edison phonograms, which became the start of the Berlin Phonogram Archiv. A decade earlier, however, Jesse Fuchs was making field cylinders of the Passamaquoddy in Maine, and a number of other sound archives, like the Vienna Phonogram Archiv, founded in 1899, and a number of other field recording projects, such as those of Franz Boas and Francis Densmore, were flourishing around this time. This was the so-called age of salvage ethnomusicology, the work of those who believed that if they got the cylinder machine out there fast enough, they could save the sounds of the noble savage, even if the noble savage was himself doomed to extinction. Such an assumption is, of course, steeped in its contemporary context and social thought, worldwide European colonialism, the white man's burden, and social Darwinism. These are the skeletons in ethnomusicology's closet. More than anything else, the guilt that has beset anthropology and all of its descendant disciplines over these philosophies and the outcomes of such thinking has become the foundation of a disciplinary rejection of archives as anything more than a convalescent home for old recordings, or, at best, a place to do preliminary research before going out into the field for the real thing. Anthropologists have judged themselves guilty of being complicit to colonialism, thus to draw one's knowledge base from the tainted waters of a repository of colonial-era documents is to become newly complicit to the sins of the past. Nobody really says this, of course. They give other reasons, which I'll discuss in a moment. 1955 marks the founding of the Society for Ethnomusicology, and it also marks an approximate breaking point between the former discipline of comparative musicology and the new ethnomusicology. Right from the beginning, however, there was a major divide within the field. Some, like Alan Merriam, favored modeling ethnomusicology as a sub-discipline of anthropology, really an anthropology of music, built on the same methodological and theoretical framework as anthropology. The anthropological model is where our traditional conception of field research comes from, with the unwritten rule that the PhD candidate must spend at least 12 months doing research in the field before coming back to write the dissertation. The other camp, whose proponents included Charles Seeger, advocated ethnomusicology as a branch of musicology, one that examined more closely the cultural context of the music at hand. The debate continues to this day, although most disciplinary frameworks are currently modeled on Merriam's anthropological conception. So, is ethnomusicology the study of music in culture, or the study of the culture in the music? There are probably few academic fields that have had such an extended identity crisis. In fact, it's my impression that the crisis practically defines ethnomusicology. It's the one thing that everyone can agree on. Nobody quite knows exactly what ethnomusicology is. Although my favorite description is, ethnomusicology is what ethnomusicologists do. As a descendant discipline of anthropology, for those who take the anthropological view, everyone can also agree that what makes it ethnomusicology is the field research. And at least that is easy to define. The researcher goes out into the field, lives among the denizens of the field, learns their language, absorbs their culture, documents their musical practices. But where is the field? I'd be inclined to say that it's the place field workers go to do field work. It used to be somewhere exotic, the savanna, the steppes, the little tribal village 150 miles upriver. That assumption is changing, though, and I'll get back to that in a minute. And this brings us up to the present, the turn of the 21st century. This is the era of rapid changes in media, and thus rapid changes in the institutions that deal with those media, namely libraries and archives. It's also a period of a paradoxical shift in interests. While the traditional builders of sound archives, meaning academic ethnomusicologists, suffer from archival ennui, the people they've been documenting are starting to discover the archives as stores of their own often lost cultural treasure. But despite this excitement, archival budgets continue to shrink. Institutional support, it seems, follows the perceived needs of the research faculty, who crank out the research that brings in the grant funding and the prestige. which is a really good reason for us to convince researchers that we're the go-to place for research materials. I mentioned the objections voiced by scholars to using archival collections as a research base. One defining methodological idea of field research and ethnomusicology in general is that it involves looking not just at the end sonic content, but perhaps more so at the cultural context that surrounds it. Archives, so the argument goes, contain sonic content, but no context. No context, no fieldwork. But anyone who has spent any time in an archive can tell you there's plenty of context there to be found. Another objection stems from the continued rejection of the old model of comparative musicology, often derided as armchair musicology, in the same way that one can be an armchair quarterback or an armchair general. This argument says that unless you've been to Country X for the mandatory 12 months, you don't have the authority to talk about Country X's music. That, I think, is also bunk, and fortunately, ethnomusicological practice is starting to catch up with this reality. A third argument against the use of archival material comes ironically from the rejection of salvage ethnomusicology. And this is ironic because all of the field documenting activity that goes into the traditional fieldwork model comes directly out of that old practice, regardless of whether the intent currently is to preserve the documentation in an archive or just to keep it on an office shelf for the researcher's own purposes. I've asked before what has changed that we should expect researchers to change their minds about us. And I mentioned changes in archives and libraries, ethnomusicology, and human media interaction. Let me go a little farther now and talk very briefly, because this in itself is a huge topic worth many conference papers, about three paradigm shifts that are happening at the confluence point between ethnomusicology and archives. The first is a change in concept of the field, or more specifically, where the field is located. Once, it was thought that the field was somewhere without running water or electricity, somewhere only accessible by boat, camel caravan, or perhaps a small airplane. Now, it is quite common to see ethnographic studies, articles, dissertations, monographs that take place in large cities and discuss very modern music. It's also becoming increasingly common to see multi-sited fieldwork, where the field travels from place to place and the researcher follows. Some examples of this are studies of musical festivals and touring ensembles. Perhaps the most telling is the rise of a whole new kind of fieldwork carried out over the internet. It's called, predictably, virtual fieldwork, or virtual ethnography, although I also like the term e-fieldwork. If fieldwork can happen online, certainly it can happen in an archive. The second shift is in the ways in which archives are operating, which, again, given the audience here, I'm sure I don't need to go into detail about. But some things that I've noticed are a broadening of mission from the traditional collection and preservation to expand into advocacy, outreach, performance, and teaching. And the internet has had its impact here, too, with the continuing growth of digital archives and libraries, online catalogs and finding aids, streaming media collections, and web broadcasting. All of these are activities which very much impact music cultures on a day-to-day basis. They also represent points of contact between archives and researchers, particularly those engaged in the newer forms of ethnomusicology, which is the third shift. While there are still plenty of scholars who follow the traditional model of going into the field for a year or more, coming back, writing it up, and filing the dissertation or publishing a book, that's not the only way to do ethnomusicology these days. Applied ethnomusicology and historical ethnomusicology are two relatively new subdisciplines that are gradually being accepted into the mainstream. And more about those in a moment. But first, the real question of this paper. How might an audiovisual archive actually be used to do field research? I think the answers are as broad as the question, so let me just suggest a few here that I've thought about. The first and most obvious way to use an archival collection is as foundational research material. That is, to get an idea of what one might expect to hear out in the field. This has been going on for years and is currently probably one of the biggest points of contact between researchers and archives. But I'm not sure that it really constitutes fieldwork, maybe something more like pre-fieldwork. A step closer to bringing the field into the archive would be a comparative study, although the word comparative is still somewhat taboo in ethnomusicology, so we'd have to call it something different. but a study nonetheless, analyzing archival recordings of a certain type of musical activity from one or perhaps several time periods in comparison with the state of that music in the present. A step beyond this is historical ethnomusicology, which focuses on using historical materials to address either the subjects or the questions of ethnomusicology, or both. Examples of this type of project include George Sawa's study on the culture of Arab music at the time of the theorist Al-Farabi, which was in the 11th century, and a number of studies of the cultural context of European art music, such as Judith Perino's work in medieval ethnomusicology. Jesse Ruskin has documented one recent example from the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive, in which the archive staff were themselves engaged actively in field documentation of the music of a large local community for an entire year. The Archiving Filipino-American Music in Los Angeles, or AFAMILA, project is one of three such initiatives that the UCLA Archive has undertaken in the last 5 years. While at first this may seem to exemplify the opposite of what I'm talking about, archivists are going into the field rather than field workers coming to the archive, it illustrates the blurring of lines that I believe, more than anything else, defines the paradigm shifts I've mentioned. It would also be an excellent starting point for research in applied ethnomusicology, another emerging sub-discipline that focuses on the impact of research in communities and typically involves such activities as public sector folklore and cultural advocacy. As one example, field research might be conducted to inquire as to how projects such as UCLA's AFAMILA function to advocate for or perpetuate the cultural traditions they represent. In recent years, a number of scholars, mostly younger scholars, it seems, for whom the guilt by association with colonialism is more of a curiosity of the past than a reality of the present, have been using historical recordings as either supporting research material or, in some cases, primary research material. And here I would include Brandon Burke's paper that you heard earlier. One hot spot I've found in the literature for such recording-centered ethnomusicology involves music in the decades surrounding the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, which, interestingly, matches up with the birth of sound recording and comparative musicology. And this brings me to my first example, my first sound example, some Greek music on 78 RPM records. To some of us, the suggestion that you could do field research with unique ethnographic field recordings is a no-brainer. But what about field research with commercial recordings? Is there anything of value there that's not watered down, passed through the culturally homogenizing filters of the recording industry? Since I work in an archive with collections that are almost exclusively commercial rather than ethnographic, this is a challenge that I've been particularly fascinated by. I should add here that these examples don't represent any sort of field research that I've done personally. More than anything, they're just some starting points where we might look to find the field within the archive. Knowing that the early 20th century of Greek music is closely tied to the recording industry, and having recently discovered a large number of 78 RPM recordings of Greek music on the shelves at Belfer, I thought this would be a good place to start. So here are just two short examples, and I'll preface this with a standard disclaimer. I don't speak Greek, and if these songs are about anybody's grandmother, I'm sorry. You might have noticed that both of those examples were made in America, which they're American record companies, I believe, which adds another dimension of the Greek immigrant populations, another ethnomusicological study area. Another example, and unfortunately I wasn't able to find the audio for this one, serves as a cautionary note to the would-be archival field worker. This was documented by Tim Brooks in a 1984 issue of the ARSC Journal, and it falls under the "don't believe everything you see printed on a record label" category. Or maybe it falls under "an opera is an opera." And here I've quoted directly from Brooks. And I'll just let you read that. Anybody who's ever heard Chinese opera, it sounds absolutely nothing like Verdi. One of the most interesting examples I found in Belfer represents quite an unlikely combination of content and container. It's a, well, if you believe the label, it's a Victrolax 78 test pressing, or rather a dub of a test pressing, of three Tibetan Buddhist dramaturgical chants. And it's a one-sided disc, and the back of the disc says Victor. I would have never matched Victor with Tibetan Buddhist music, but here's a short sample.
Boys and girls, I mentioned doctors a moment ago.
That's the next example. Finally, I'd like to end with this example of spoken word rather than music. I'm going to subtitle this one, "The Things You Learn at a Record Sale." As some of you know, we recently had a record sale at the Belfer Archive. In casual conversation with one collector who stopped by, and conversation is, after all, a part of doing fieldwork, I learned of a small record label, Droll Yankees, that released about a dozen LPs in the 60s, documenting rural New England folklore and folk music. So naturally, I checked to see if we had any of those on the shelves at Belfer, and as it happens, we had one, a graduation speech given by Francis Colburn to a group of new doctors. And remember that listening to stories is another part of doing fieldwork.
Oh, and that puts me in mind of another parable, the parable of the young wolf in the doctor's office. And I know as this story unfolds that some of you gentlemen are going to get a little bit edgy. But you don't have to, because this story don't end the same way as your version of it does. It seemed that there was a young wolf who, feeling sort of poorly, visited the doctor's office, and there in the waiting room he found his friend the fox. "Well, wolf," says fox, "you poorly?" "Yes," says wolf. "Well, sir," says fox, "this doctor's a real humdinger, a real whing-ding, a veritable socceroo. You see that elk just leaving? Well, he had..." No, it isn't the same story. "Well, he had ptomaine poison, and the doc cut off his toe." "That's so," said wolf, getting kind of edgy. "Yes, sir," says fox, "and you seen that rabbit just leaving? Well, sir, he had erysipelas, and the doc cut off his ears." "Yes, sir." "That's so," says wolf, kind of thoughtful. And by now, he was looking sort of peaked. And sort of green. And he grabbed his hat and he left, saying, "I'm going to grab my hat and leave. I've got asthma."
I hope I've contributed something meaningful to the conversation about bringing archives and ethnomusicology back into a productive partnership. It's an area I'll personally be exploring for quite a while. I'm excited to hear how this conversation progresses and what kind of changes it might lead to. Thank you.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes for questions.
Hi, I have as an ethnomusicologist, I have a question, and maybe I'm playing devil's advocate, but it seems to me if you take the real sort of Merriam Anthro standpoint, mm-hmm. what we're interested in is not how we hear the music, but how they hear the music. So from that, and literally I mean that you can't perceive it the same way that it's being perceived by people of another culture. And I know that from personal example mm-hmm. in our archives.
Sure.
So I'm wondering what you have to say about that. I mean, how would you answer that?
That's one of the big sort of stumbling blocks, is this idea of filters. Anything that is not firsthand is is filtered, and so therefore is one or more steps away from the pure source. I think that while there is certainly some truth to that, you know, nobody knows how a certain person perceives their music more than that person. Researchers in ethnomusicology and in other fields deal with source materials that are further removed from the source than just once, than just a direct field recording, especially a field recording that is, you know, that's well made. There are certainly arguments that, depending on how the recording is made, especially if it's engineered, if it's commercially produced, things might have been cut, edited. That changes the interpretation of the music that you hear, or the words or anything on the recording. In the end, it's, you know, sort of the standard line of historians is that history is all interpretation, and I think that that extends to the work that ethnomusicologists do. Obviously, we want to be careful of our sources, but I think personally that a field recording, or even a commercial recording that is done in a respectful way, is a pretty solid document. And yes, it's interpreted by the ethnomusicologist, but that's also true of any monograph. That's their interpretation of their experience in the field.
Aaron, what's your read on musicologists' acceptance of recorded archive materials as sort of an indicator of changing styles and perhaps, dare we say, pollution by other media sources in musical practices?
It's interesting. I don't follow historical musicology as closely, but it seems that there's been this explosion within historical musicology of interest in music of the 20th century and going beyond the art music composers, talking about musical theater, popular music. A lot of musicologists are studying American pop music in a way that even ethnomusicologists aren't touching. Sort of a bit of irony there. And in those circles, these studies of recordings seem to be fairly popular. In terms of classical music, there are some that I'm aware of. Stephen Meyer, who does research at Belfer, is one. He researches in German late 19th century and early 20th century opera. I don't know at this point how well accepted that is among the sort of old school tweed jacket and leather patch wearing musicologists. I'm not plugged into that crowd enough, but I think that it will become more and more accepted. I think it will become another standard mode of doing historical musicology, along with score study and early document study.
Hello, I'm right in front of the speaker, so we'll get a lot of feedback here. My name's Brad Keating. I'm with SIL. I'm kind of in between ethnomusicology and linguistics. So, in linguistics, one of the current trends or hot topics or something is documentary linguistics as opposed to descriptive linguistics, in light of the fact that there's a lot of endangered cultures, endangered languages right now that. Just due to the pressures of globalization are looking to be, you know, wiped out very soon. Documentary linguistics is a lot like going out and collecting certain word lists or communicative events or something like that, preserving that in an archive and leaving that as your primary source material, not necessarily to be analyzed like descriptive linguistics would then go produce a grammar and a phonology. Mm-hmm. But that's based on somebody's theoretical framework.
Right.
And that makes it even a step further removed from the primary source for future analysts.
Right.
So I'm just thinking that in ethnomusicology, you could be looking at a similar trend now of documentary ethnomusicology, where it's kind of like a throwback to the old, you know, a century ago, being a song catcher.
Right.
You know, where you're trying to preserve things for heritage, even for cultural revitalization or in applied ethnomusicology, say, or something like that. It's more of a comment than a question, but I'm just, you know, what's your take on, you know, you're looking at archives as stuff we've done in the 20th century, mm-hmm. you know, but now in 21st century, we're still looking to put a lot of stuff into archives for future use.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that could be another, outlet, especially, and this touches on the proliferation of media, especially digital media, and the changing way that the human media interaction occurs. And I mentioned that and didn't really get into it, but one of the products of that is we do have a lot more media streaming into archives and nothing that can really be done with it. So we might come to a point where we start saying, okay, we'll start stockpiling this stuff for a while in the idea that we can research it. That is sort of what happened 100 years ago, as you mentioned, with salvage ethnomusicology and song catchers and all of that. They were making cylinders like crazy and putting them into archives, and then an awful lot of them just rotted or got destroyed. So it's sort of dangerous, you know, a dangerous bet to make. The issue of how many steps removed from the pure source, so to call it, is still always an issue. And I think that it's always going to be something to be negotiated, but not necessarily feared.
just real quick.
One more question.
Yeah. John Bondoran from Berea College, and a disclaimer first, I'm not an ethnomusicologist, and I don't play one on TV, but as an archivist and doing preservation work, we have, you know, extensive collections of field work that are, and, you know, really I've seen in the last couple of years more work, like you're saying, kind of a combination of the sort of pre-field work and even people, scholars, examining the culture of collecting and the nature of collecting and what those, and even someone who looked at collections as composition. And so, I mean, we're, and going to what this gentleman was saying, you know, there was that in the song catcher, you know, that tradition, but also now it's this, you know, sort of re-examining the work. And yes, there are filters, but it's, we're sort of uncovering, you know, maybe even uncovering the layers or the filters and seeing what was being done. And say now, especially the cross-cultural between different collections, what was sort of overlapping. And I've seen that a lot, and I think that, you know, that's what we're here to provide, you know, that's why we exist.
You make a lot of good points there, and yes, I think that we could find archives, among other things, being the site of a sort of recording archaeology in a way where we have these records of the past. And, you know, just like if you dig up bones and pottery from 4,000 years ago, you can't for certain make an interpretation on them, but there are best educated guesses. Things like documenting, recording culture, record collecting culture, music industry culture, that's another area that I didn't get into, but that's another really big potential, especially for archives that house a lot of commercial materials. In a way, you've got sort of a secondary history of the recording industry going there. You know, to be sure, it's analyzed in a different way, but it's really a story of that culture in the last 100 years.
I think we're heading on to the lunch hour. I'm sure our speakers could stay a couple of minutes if you have extra questions. I want to thank Aaron very much. I also want to thank Brandon, and I want to thank Sonia as well for what's really been a fun and interesting session. And thank all of you for coming. And it looks like we might have an announcement from our esteemed program.
Just one quick announcement. The people who are redeeming these coupons for a free copy of the CD Actionable Offenses tell me that occasionally someone will come and drop one off on the assumption that it might be mailed or something. No, actually, you give them this sheet and they'll give you the CD right there. So just let there be no misunderstanding about that. You can give them this and walk away with a CD. All I have to say.